It's nice to welcome the weather warriors in the assembly who have survived and come. And it's great to welcome the diaspora who are still trying to snuggle and stay warm at home. It's good to see all of you. This morning, I wonder if any of you are anxious. I think I have a right to be anxious. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be heading out to Rwanda to teach some executive leaders from 9 different African countries. And it's halfway around the world. And I've taken many trips in the last 40 years across this world, but this is the first time I'm doing it by myself. So I have a right to be anxious a little bit, mainly because my daughter just took that trip and turned a 30-hour nice little trip into a 60-hour nightmare. Now, she started off, my wife and I got the 4 a.m. call to take them to the airport. That was no problem. We got them there. They got their luggage checked in. And when they got through to the gate, they were told that the plane has mechanical problems, so it's going to be an hour delay. Well, they had an hour and a half layover in Washington, D.C., so they thought, okay, we're going to be okay. The hour passed, and then the announcement came on, sorry, the mechanical issue is still not fixed, so we're going to have to delay longer. That meant they had to find another plane, so they went to an agent to try, and then the announcement came on, no, we've got it fixed, come on in. So they ran on the plane, they took off, they landed, they have my daughter and her husband have 4 kids. They took another family with 2 kids, so they have 6 young kids, and they're racing through Washington, and they missed the plane by 2 minutes. So now they have to go through and find a whole nother way to travel. So they find a ticket agent, find another way. They have to fly over to Newark, New Jersey, to continue the flight, and they have to stay 11 hours overnight in the airport while they're waiting for the plane with 6 kids. So 11 hours, they take off their 13-hour flight. They arrive in Dubai. This is where they're taken. And another 11 hours in that airport with 6 kids. They finally survive that. 4 hours down to Kigali. They arrive in Rwanda. They're going to Uganda, but they arrive in Rwanda. Find out 6 of their bags are not with them. They needed these 6 bags because they're doing children's camps and all the equipment is in these bags. They're doing it over December, so they've taken Christmas presents because my daughter and her husband have worked with street boys and orphans. They developed a ministry there over the years. And so they're going back for a reunion, to celebrate, to do all kinds of things. So they got there. Finally, in Rwanda, the bags are missing. So they wait a day, hoping some of them will come. 5 of them do show up as they're traveling up to Uganda. They drive up to Uganda in their room. They find out there's no real power the time they're there. Their couch has hosted a colony of mice, which take joy in running over their faces in the middle of the night. And so this is their excitement. Their meals take 3 hours to prepare. So once or twice a day, they get their meals. And they get through the camps, they get through the visitation, they get through their whole ministry time, they survive. And then they head back to Rwanda, they contact the airport only to find out that the travel agent who changed their tickets canceled their trips coming home. And my son-in-law has to be back, they timed it so perfectly, at midnight the night before, he has to be at work the next morning or he's gonna lose his job. So this is the excitement. And I'm going to go on a trip. Have you ever been anxious? Do you remember the last time you were anxious, feeling alone, overwhelmed? I mean, even Christians can feel these feelings, right? And at times like this, you don't feel like your mind is whole, like it's at peace, like you're working out of health and strength and confidence. I mean, who feels this way, anxious, right? I mean, young parents responsible for raising kids, right? You feel anxious at times. Students who are facing exams and assignments, people working through challenging relationships, singles having to make significant life choices, seniors facing life limits and health issues, people thinking about housing, moving. Employees and employers, drivers thinking about insurance and fuel costs and roads and weather, citizens wondering who to vote for, new immigrants wondering how to belong, pretty well all of us, and sometimes more than at other times. Anxiety lets us know that we feel that our needs are not being met, but feelings shift, don't they? When you're filled with anxiety, you can't put your whole heart into life. You can only be wholehearted and whole-minded if God's peace is filling you. So today we're going to be looking into the book of Philippians, and we're going to focus on the phrase, "The Lord is near." And this phrase carries the weight of two ideas which are going to help us deal with the feelings of aloneness, of anxiety, of fear in our circumstances. And the two ideas are first that Jesus himself is near to us by his caring, by his control, by being fully aware of what we're facing. And the second idea is that Jesus is near because he's coming soon to set the world right, to hold everyone accountable, to release us from the pain and trauma we may be facing. So the Lord is near. And that truth is the foundation to keep us whole-minded and at peace when the world around us seems out of control. There are enough anxious people around us. We don't need to be among them. So Paul, the writer of this letter, is saying that one of the things he wants followers of Jesus and others to know is this truth that God is intimately and ultimately involved in our world. And that reality forms this basis for whole-mindedness so we can live and enjoy life as it was designed to be lived. Now, to the philosophers in Athens, Paul, who realizes they question everything, says this: "The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man, he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their land. And God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us." He's near. That's what Paul is saying. "For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring." So Paul quotes the Cretan philosopher named Epimenides and the Cilician philosopher named Aratus, and he's implying here that even people who don't know Jesus somehow can have a sense that God is near. But for Christians, the difference is that we not only sense that he is near, we live like it. And this is what makes a difference to all who see us. So Paul lets us know that there are four things that are impacted when we know the Lord is near. And these four things are foundational to make us whole-minded. So Paul says that we are whole-minded when our character, when our confidence, when our contemplation, and when our conduct align to bring us peace. So let's look at the first thing that is impacted when we realize that the Lord is near, and that's our character in verses 4 and 5. We read in verse 4 and 5, "Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again." What? Rejoice, right? "Let your gentleness be evident to all because the Lord is near." Exactly. So Paul highlights two areas of our character here. And we see that through our will, we actively choose joy, regardless of our circumstances. And through our relationships, we actively choose to respond in gentleness, regardless of how others are treating us. Now, the Philippian church lives in a society that did not appreciate their message or appreciate their values. Their world was even more hostile toward them than ours is toward us. They didn't have a say in who their government was going to be. They didn't have a say in the realm of religion or politics or law or business. But the main thing they brought into the arena of humanity is their character. They worked to display the character of Jesus, and that made them stand out like stars in the universe, Paul says. Why joy? Why gentleness? Well, in Jesus' last charge to his followers, in John 16, he tells them that his coming departure after his crucifixion is going to bring grief. But that grief is going to turn to joy. He says in verse 22, "Now is your time of grief, but I will see you again, and you will rejoice, and no one will take away your joy. In that day you will no longer ask me anything. Very truly, I tell you, my Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. Until now, you have not asked for anything in my name. Ask and you will receive, and your joy will be complete." I can tell you I had great joy when Michelle's family finally got home. I will have great joy when one day I see Jesus and I see my mom and dad again in heaven. I have that joy to look forward to. But I can have joy here. On Friday, we had the funeral service for my chosen son-in-law, Graham, when he passed away at a young age. But we could know we have joy now because of the hope that we have, that we will see again, even though his life was cut short. Joy is the confirmation to this world that we are living with a certainty about who is in control of life as we know it. So no matter what happens in the courts, in the parliaments, in the war councils, in the city halls, in the airports, we know whose hand is ultimately in charge, and we are going to choose to rejoice because of that. Joy means that we've got a long-term perspective about reality, and we see past what is just for now. Jesus is coming, and that coming is near. So we release control of life to God, all of life, the good, the bad, the ugly. The Lord is near. He's caring. He's comforting. The Lord is near. He's coming to rescue us and to hold everyone accountable. And we can rejoice because of that. It's not up to us to fix everything and to bring about justice here and now on our own. Joy is something we can embrace. But why gentleness? Scripture tells us four things about Jesus' character. It says that in John 1:14, he came full of grace and truth. This is his character, who he is. Matthew 11:28 says this, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am what? I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Did you see that? Gentleness is a key mark of Jesus. Gentleness doesn't mean weakness or even meekness. It means strength under control. And if you have all power imaginable, as Jesus did, and you have to deal with jabbering clods of dust who mock you and refuse to believe in you, what could you do in response? Have you ever seen those bug zappers? They look like little tennis rackets with electrified strings or other things. You're out camping, and there's this nasty horsefly coming, and you go, zap! Take him out. You see a hornet coming to steal your chicken, zap! Got him. See a moth bothering you at night, zap! Got him. I mean, Jesus could do that. But he doesn't. His strength is under control. And Paul says the same thing about you and about me. Let your gentleness be evident to all. Let the way you respond to the mocking, to the abuse, to the oppression, to the misunderstanding, to the doubt, to the slander, to the adverse circumstances, respond in your relationships with gentleness. Now, why is that character so important for believers? As followers of Jesus, as Christians, little Christs, we're meant to be a reflection of Jesus. What gets the press and non-believers pointing in our direction? It's if our character falls short. if we react with fury, if we're dishonest, if we're abusive, if we fall into addictions, then the world either gets a distorted picture of who Jesus is, or they dismiss us as hypocritical, since we don't accurately reflect him. So do you really live like Jesus is near you? Ask yourself two things. Do I choose to live with joy in my circumstances? And do I choose to live with gentleness in my relationships? If you can get these two things right, you will set an opening for when you want to tell others about why you believe in a living Savior who is in our world today. So character is the first thing to get right if we're going to let the world know that we believe that the Lord is near. The second thing that we need to get right is seen in verse 5-7, our confidence. Jesus is near is to give us this sense of confidence. It's to give us a peace of mind that's going to carry into our circumstances. Now, if there's one thing the world doesn't need more of, it's anxiety. All you have to do is turn on the news to get a few minutes that will give you a recipe for anxiety. You turn it on and you hear about trade wars and real wars and gang wars and internet sabotage and political interference in house prices and gas prices and food prices and immigration chaos, and on it goes. I talked about camping. When we go camping in the summer, about 30, 40 of us from the family like to go out and camp together at Cultus Lake. And one of the things that the 11 grandkids love to do and the others go down to the wharf and jump in the lake. Our youngest grandchild, Eliana, for the last couple of years, she'd run out onto the wharf with the others with her water wings on, but there was a hesitancy to jump until her grandmother, Gail, Nyanya, came close. When she was near, there was confidence to jump, and she could brave it. Here, we read, the Lord is near. This is our confidence. He's near. Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Now, let's face it, it talks about prayer here, but for some of us, prayer is more a duty or a discipline that we kind of do at meals or first thing in the morning, whenever we are in desperate need. It's more that kind of a thing than a delight that draws us into realizing that Jesus is near. There are just too many distractions in our world, right? I mean, you've got technology and money and busyness and science and news and malls and gadgets and Netflix and games and hobbies and friends and nature. I mean, there's so many distractions that you don't have time for prayer. It's not a delight for us. Do you remember Peter walking on the water? After the feeding of the 5,000, the disciples were out on the lake. They were caught in this huge storm. They had no nyanya to jump to. Jesus walked out into the middle of the night, and they were terrified, thinking he was a ghost. And he told them to take courage, not to be afraid. So Peter says, if it's really you, tell me to come and walk on the water toward you. So Jesus says, come. This is what we read. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and began to sink. He cried out, Lord, save me. Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. You have little faith, he said. Why did you doubt? Jesus was near, but he was distracted from that nearness. Anxiety comes because we look for solutions to big problems in little places. There was a stat recently that said 30% of 20 to 35-year-olds have suffered some kind of mental illness. Some of you know the digital age started in seriousness in 2007. 5 years later, 2012, psychologists were noticing a huge spike in mental illness. And they tried to think about why, and that's when they realized that 50% of the population in 2012 now had cell phones. The average iPhone user apparently touches their screen 2,617 times a day. Millennials, over 5,000 times a day. That's over 2.5 hours on your phone, 76 sessions, and that proliferation is just growing. No wonder we don't have time to think about the Lord being near. They say that secularism, the fact that you don't even think about the Lord, secularism is the highest cause of neurosis in our society. The Lord was near. And Peter could see it, but he didn't feel it. Only Peter didn't live out that reality. And when we're anxious, we kind of smear God's reputation, don't we? We make it look like he's not wise enough, he's not good enough, he's not powerful enough, he's not caring enough, he's not aware enough to be involved in the life of his own children. Certainly not near to us. And it's true that these anxiety disorders can develop from a complex set of genetics and brain chemistry and personality and life events, but anxiety is also going to stifle your spiritual life if you feel alone, if you're forgetting that Jesus is with you in complete control of all that is happening. Now, 1 in 5 of us is going to probably be on a pill for some form of anxiety, since it's the most common form of mental illness. And if you've got an anxiety disorder, you're probably running to the doctor more. You're probably making more trips for help. And it's important that you get to be part of a community group that prays for you and support you and encourages you. It's important to be reminded in the community that Jesus is near. Pastor John Mark Comer says that prayer is our portal to life with God. It reminds us that Jesus is near. And this verse that I've got here is one that I memorize almost on a daily basis to remember over and over again. I'd encourage you to remember it if you don't have it memorized already. It helps you realize that Jesus is big enough to handle our circumstances, whatever they are. I mean, he took on the sins of the world. He defeated the devil and death. He rose from the dead. He can handle what's going on in your life. 1 Peter 5 says, "Humble yourself, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up in due time. Cast all your cares on him, because he cares for you." Perhaps there's people in the congregation here that you know of who are models of those who act like God, like the Lord is near. Seek out their support, their prayer, their encouragement. The Philippian church in Paul's day was wrestling with leaders who were struggling in their relationship with each other. There was a battle among leaders in the church. There were others who were facing persecution. There were others who were wondering how Paul was going to deal with his prison time. There was a member who was gravely ill. There was plenty of things to keep them anxious. And Paul says, still, in the middle of all this, be anxious for nothing. One of the things I've done with my counselees is to ask them to take an image. Imagine holding the thing that creates anxiety in your hands, and then picture handing it over to Jesus, letting go of it. Paul tells us that prayer is a key part of exchanging peace for anxiety. And he says, in every situation, through your prayers, through your petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. Don't forget the thanksgiving. Thanksgiving reorients your mind, and it takes your vision from off the waves and onto the controller of the waves. Now, this word peace, shalom, captures the sense of whole-mindedness that we're talking about. Peace means it's about your well-being, it's healthy, it's hopeful, and that's what God is offering you in exchange for your anxiety. Pastor John Piper says, when we let our requests be made known to God like this, in the devotion of prayer, in many specific requests for help, with a heart that is thankful for everything God designs for us, the pleasures and the pain, then his peace will guard our minds and free us from anxiety in a way that defies mere rational explanation. It surpasses all understanding. So nothing happens in your life out of his control. So pray with thanks, embrace peace, and you will experience a confidence that others will wonder at. And they'll know that you really believe Jesus is near. So for whole-mindedness, first thing, align your character and your confidence around the truth that God is near, and then consider your contemplation. That's the next thing. And by contemplation, I'm not talking about the emptying of your mind in yoga or the mindfulness that is being taught the kids in schools and to some of you in exercise classes. Paul never sees people as out of control with their thoughts. Our key thought is that Jesus is near. This is where we're to focus our thoughts. And that's what enables us to reorient our mind to other key things. So here's the verse he gives us. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Think about things that help you flourish as a human being. You see, we're kind of messed up in our thinking, right? When we do things wrong, we focus on our failures, we focus on the things that aren't going well, and we get anxious about these things. We're at the mercy of our ideas that swim around in our head. They shape who we become. And we can even embrace unreality and believe lies. So Paul is not just saying, I want you to be positive thinking. He wants us to be whole-minded. And the filters that Paul lists for our thoughts are not just designed to achieve good karma or an inner harmony or an alignment with the good forces of the universe. He calls us to think God's thoughts after him, to live in line with the design and the desires that God has created us for. In Psalm 139, we read, You have searched me, O Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. So, Lord, you understand the motives of my heart. You know the emotions behind the words that I share. You understand every thought behind what I say. Knowing this, knowing that you are that near, impacts what I think and what I say. So I want to think twice before I speak once. There are so many words, so many images, so many messages coming our way. We've got social media and phones and relationships and advertising and internet and conversations and reading and television and radio. And man, you probably get thousands of things to think about every day, don't you? To distract you, to become an issue that creates anxiety for you. Your mind is just overwhelmed with these messages. Sometimes anxiety is like a guard dog, right? And it's trying to protect you from all these things and a perceived threat. And sometimes it's good to say, thank you, anxiety, for feeling so strongly in my body, but you don't have to protect me. Jesus is here. He can protect me. And sometimes your anxiety is like a big black dog with muddy paws, and it jumps on you and attacks you. And sometimes you just have to say, down, down, and just choose not to think these things. Not all of the messages that come your way are helpful, right? What can you do to live like Jesus is near? Put a filter on your thoughts. And Paul provides a good filter here. And I use that for myself every day. And I repeat it to myself. Whatever is noble, right, pure, lovely, admirable, excellent, praiseworthy, I actively try to turn my mind towards these things. That doesn't mean you're just thinking about the sermon all day, but hopefully it comes within that grid. Face reality. If you put garbage into your mind is going to remember it and bring it back at the worst of times. And the enemy loves to bring temptation through your thoughts, accusations based on what's going on in your mind, and you become divided in your thinking, and whole-mindedness evaporates no matter how much you value it, no matter how much you want it. Now, there are great avenues that you can get to bring things to mind, things like music and art and stories and nature and relationships. But Paul never assumes that the world we're in has nothing good worth offering. There is a lot of good things in our world, and you can see it in art and literature and technology and history and architecture, philosophy, science, even psychology. All of that can make life better. But Paul knows, because we're humans made in God's image, that there's still a sense of good and bad, right and wrong, duty and irresponsible, beauty and ugliness, honor and shame. So in this letter to the Romans, Paul is saying, God has written a sense of his law on our hearts, what he wants of us. But that still doesn't mean we just consume everything without discernment. It doesn't mean we watch or read whatever is available, that we listen to whatever is out there, that we consume anything and everything, that we ignore the choices and the actions of others. God has left us as moral agents, as lights in a dark world, as truth speakers, as people of discernment with voices and minds. So say yes to what is true and noble and right and pure and lovely and admirable and excellent and praiseworthy. And think about those things. Think about that as a foundation for whole-mindedness. One more thing. Conduct. If we're going to be whole-minded, our character may be focused on joy in our circumstances and gentleness in our relationships, because the Lord is near. Our confidence may be based in thankful prayer that leads to shalom, to a peace, because the Lord is near. Our contemplation may be filtered through flourishing thoughts that come our way, because the Lord is near. But if that isn't worked out in your conduct, you may find yourself in your own little happy bubble and have no real impact on the world around you. And I've got breaking news, if you haven't heard it from Pastor Tommy or others, and I'm sure you have. We weren't put on this planet just to get ourselves happy. We have a purpose to make disciples of Christ from all nations, and that means making a difference in the world around you. Whatever you have learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, put it into practice, and the God of peace will be with you. That's what Paul says. How would you act or react differently in your community if you knew Jesus was with you? Guess what? He is with you. The Lord is near. And Paul says the peace of God is the end product of whole-mindedness. But this comes only as we put into practice the good things we have learned. And all of us in the body of Christ have teachers that we can learn from. We have brothers and sisters who know God in ways we would like to know. We have prayer warriors who know how to speak and listen to God. We have people who have gifts of generosity and hospitality, those who are going to be helping in our time afterwards here. We have people who have gifts of service and mercy and helps. We have people who have gifts of encouragement and wisdom. And those brothers and sisters are purposed by God to be in the body in order for us to be whole-minded together. And we live out what we know as we see that the Lord is near. So whole-mindedness is completed when our character, when our confidence, when our contemplation, and when our conduct align to move us toward peace. So if you're unsettled today, if you're anxious, if you're feeling alone, if you're wrestling with life as it unfolds around you, take some time to review what Paul is saying in Philippians 4. The world is watching. It's waiting. And whether it knows it or not, it's hoping that what we're offering is true. Oh, they're going to test to see if it's real and lasting. They're going to test your conduct, because that's where they're going to see it. Brennan Manning, an author, says the greatest single cause of atheism in the world today is Christians who acknowledge Jesus with their lips, then walk out the door and deny him by their lifestyle. That is what an unbelieving world simply finds unbelievable. Perhaps the greatest force against atheism, then, is believers who not only say the Lord is near, but live like it. I recently read a series of stories about finding God in unexpected places. And some people wrote about finding God in their broken down marriage, others when they lost a loved one, others when they were in the hospital, others with perfect strangers who just had a word for them at the most time that they needed it. And the one thing that all of them realized is that the God who they felt was far away in that moment was actually near. Because God is near, in fact, living in us, he may prompt you to be one of those who brings his nearness to others. What is the difference? What will make the difference for you and them is if your character and your confidence and your contemplation and your conduct are aligning in a lifestyle of peace. And if you sense today that one of these areas is out of alignment for you, you have leaders, friends here in this family who can help you. Come to them, talk to them, get them to pray with you and for you. Help them to see that the Lord is near. The God who is near can bring to mind clearly, and I'd encourage you right now as we close, that if you sense God speaking to you, that you do the work you need to draw your character, your confidence, your contemplation, your conduct into alignment. The Lord is near. That means he's aware, he cares, and he'll comfort through his word, his spirit, and his people. It also means he's coming back soon. He's going to make all things right. He's going to hold the world accountable before him. The Lord is near. Today, let's put our hope in him wherever you find yourself today, because that's the only way we're going to be whole-minded and at peace in a world that's filled with anxiety. I want to encourage you with that. So as Pastor Tommy comes to lead us in our doxology, would you just do your work with the Lord, please?